Talk Radio, it's time for the Daily Service, led by Judy Merry. And here on Radio 4 FM, we continue our Book of the Week, Alexandria, by Peter Stothard. In the first few days of 2011, the author arrived in the Egyptian city to fulfil his ambition to write a book about Cleopatra. In his room at the Hotel Metropole, he unpacks the notes and fragments of earlier attempts, and these versions of the famous Queen's stories conjure memories of his own life, beginning with his Essex childhood. The reader is Kenneth Cranham.
Once upon a time, there was a Professor James Rame, an ageless, characterless male who knew Cleopatra personally. He loved her. He loved her because she was beautiful, bold, and smelt like my mother. This professional alien, space traveller, and hero of a long-lost adventure at the courts of Alexandria was my first and only fictional creation. I was 10 years old. Professor Rame and the Egyptian Queen, a fantasy of golden hair and blue skies, or so I like to think, was written in what my parents used to call a box room, almost square. It contained a high wooden desk, and it doubled as a home for water tanks and staircase support. Just as in room 114 at the Metropole, it was easiest to write there while standing. The rest of the little red brick house and the Marconi Works estate, a mile from Chelmsford, was filled with radio noises, Mrs. Dale's diary, and the permanent hum of a Hoover. But in the windowless box room, there was silence. I would give much now for a few sentences on how Cleopatra and the professor first met. But the name is all there is. Sometimes one just has to accept the absence of memory as better than the pretense of it. There is nothing so very wrong in remembering only a name. Much of what we know of antiquity are names, the names of lost people, plays, histories, the names of learned treatises, works on medicine, on how to prevent slaves escaping, and how to apply makeup. My own Cleopatra, as I saw her then, the seventh woman of her name to rule in Egypt after its submission to the Greek generals of Alexander the Great, wrote a treatise about makeup. Or maybe she had a name attached to someone else's lipstick tips. Librarians and booksellers even then believed that a work was more likely to be read under the name of a celebrity. If history had happened differently, mascara might have been all we knew about her. Instead, she became the lover of two great Roman generals, and as some came to say, changed the history of the Western world. In our house, there was no time for the nonsense of any history older than the century. Engineering was the necessity, in our case, radar engineering. For my father and the men who lived around us, seeing the invisible was a profoundly practical matter. Max Stothard was a designer of military machines that made us safe. Ours were homes built in anxious haste below a giant steel aerial mast that had been erected against the communists as soon as the Nazi threat was passed. There were many advantages for us on these company streets. We had miniature radios when most of the country still kept the BBC in big wooden boxes. Professor Rame's career began with the bedroom sound of science fiction, bluff Englishmen bringing their voices to Mars and the Moon. Books, by contrast, were rare. There were just 5 of them in 51 Dorset Avenue. The brightest coloured being a sky blue edition of S.T. Coleridge, the title printed in such a way that for years I thought that the poet was a saint. Next to this sat a collected Tennyson in a spongy leather cover. On the shelf below was a cricket scorebook in which someone had copied improving philosophical precepts, and beside that, the first test match, a slim, slate-green hardback. This was the one that looked read and reread. The fifth book is the only one that is with me in Alexandria 50 years on. My Nottinghamshire grandfather's copy of the second half of Virgil's Aeneid, book 7-12, with the name B. Stothard in a firm, faded script inside the flyleaf. Professor Rame's adventure, my own first Cleopatra, owed a little to Bert Stothard's Aeneid, but more as an opening to an ancient world than a guide to what was in it, more as an object than as a text. I could not make sense of Latin yet. Ours was a community of algebra and graph paper. Mathematics was the language of choice. My curly-headed, smiling father had a brain for numbers that his fellow engineers described as Rolls-Royce. Notoriously, he did not like to test it beyond a purr. In particular, and this was unusual in a place of intense educational self-help, he did not care to inculcate maths into his son. This was a task that he had recognized early as wholly without reward. My mother had bigger worries than in numeracy. She had heard from rival mothers that I had damp eyes when stories were read in class, not necessarily even the saddest stories. I was much too open to the world around me, absorbent almost. She put this failing in different words at different times. Professor Rame and his Egyptian queen were among many bad influences. It was better that I spent more time outside. In the real world, everything would always be fine. My mother was a shy connoisseur of small improvements and social distinctions. Were the engineers' families of Rothmans Avenue, Dorset Avenue, and Noakes Avenue truly quite the same? Did the more brilliant scientists live in Rothmans, the more managerial in Dorset, the more clerical in Noakes? Who took a daily newspaper? Who took the Daily Telegraph? My father played Tom Lehrer's mutually assured destruction song, "We'll All Go Together When We Go," when guests came for a drink. But was this acceptable or not? Why was Peter not out with Morris, the bank manager's son? Why was he always stuck in that box room? My father read the fiction that I wrote about my manufactured hero, Professor Rame. He even praised it. There was no future in it, but he was never much concerned about the future. I wish I could say that he'd first introduced me to Cleopatra, but there was only a short consultation a few years later. He consulted me, which is why I remember it, about whether ancient names would be suitable for Marconi weapon systems. Would Caesar or Cicero be better than Blue Streak or Blue Steel for the weapons guided by our great metal tower, the one that protected the estate from electric storms and the British state from communism? How about Cleopatra? Absolutely not, he said. A missile could not be named after a woman, even a queen. Bibliotheca Alexandrina. An hour ago, Mahmoud sent a message to the Sea Fountain Cafe where my new friends had told me to wait for them. I'm to meet him here at the Alexandria Library, anywhere close to the catalogues. The new Alexandrian Library is invisible until it is reached, a shallow bowl of glass by the sea. Waste paper is swirling in the wind. The hot chocolate cafes are empty. An armed guard of anxious young soldiers waits and watches, as though for a visit from unusually senior officers. The only welcome came from headscarved school students scampering through the sculpture park between a green stone tornado, a green crescent moon, and a grey head of the great Alexander. The first library of the Ptolemies was an extraordinary creation of the human mind, the definer of learning itself. Here was the first collection that aimed to hold all books from everywhere. Other kings had built collections to show that they and their kingdoms were great. Alexandria celebrated the greatness of everything its rulers could borrow, steal, or buy. No one knows what the first library looked like or how large it was, but we do know what was done here. Destruction is always the word that accompanies Alexandrian library in books. The first library here has long been famous for its death, even though no one can agree precisely how that death began or ended. Some blame Cleopatra's first visit from a careless Julius Caesar, the spread of flames from ship to shore. Others blame the Christians or the Arabs or other Vandals. This is a library built at Greek billionaires' expense to remind Egyptians and their visitors that Greeks made this city and that there is more to history here than pyramids and pharaohs. What do I do while waiting for the promised arrival of my guides? First, I ask myself to forgive my own vanity. Secondly, I seek my own name in the catalogues and ask, only idly, what, if anything of me, has survived this far. In the print catalogue there is a French translation of my first book, 30 Days, a daily diary which covered my time spent with Tony Blair and George W. Bush during the Iraq War in 2003. This 30 jours will possibly impress Mahmoud. Is it worthwhile ordering any other books? 2 desks away, there is a huge pile of Latin classics awaiting an absent reader's attention, each one tagged with its own ticket. The Aeneid is in a single dark blue volume. Its requester may not come. If he or she does arrive, I can politely return it or wait to see if its absence is noted. The Aeneid was the epic that Rome's first emperor, Octavian, who called himself Augustus, hoped would expunge the memory of Cleopatra, a figure whom he made a symbol of everything he was against. The Egyptian queen was, in this version, a seductress, an oriental, a capricious autocrat who melted pearls in wine. Her conqueror intended Virgil's poem as a victory speech, proof that Alexandria had been defeated and true Roman virtues made triumphant. But immediately, I'm bidden to stop. A librarian appears, as though to take back the book for its rightful borrower. There is a thudding behind her. Mahmoud and Socrates are finally here, waiting impatiently by the catalogues, not allowed further entry because it's too close to closing time. They are gesturing at me to come out. I point to my watch. I will be with them in a few minutes. There are limits to being led by unknown guides. This Bibliotheca Alexandrina cost $250 million to build. Greek shipowners and Arab sheikhs all paid their part. This wonder of the modern world is especially loved by President Mubarak and his wife, or so Mahmoud told me. It is tasteful, broad and low. Its roof is a tilted sundial. Its terraces are filled with sculpture. Its rows of desks cascade down towards the sea. It is like an elaborate ornament to a garden. It does not contain many books. It may not be much of a library at all.
Kenneth Cranham was reading from Alexandria, The Last Nights of Cleopatra by Peter Stothard. It was abridged and produced by Jill Waters and is a Waters Company production for BBC Radio 4.
Back on BBC Radio 4.
Hello, I'm Brian Cox.
And I'm Robin Ince, and we have a new series of The Infinite Monkey Cage where we're going to be asking questions such as, when is a strawberry dead? What indeed is death? And should Brian Blessed be sent to Mars?
Do your impression.
I want to go to Mars! And I want to go to Mars now! Send me to Mars! Send me to Mars!
Is roughly what happens for half an hour. It's wonderful.
The award-winning guide to science and the universe.
The Infinite Monkey Cage!
With Professor Brian Cox and Robin Ince.
That hurts, by the way. It's really painful. I don't know how he keeps it up all day.
Next Monday afternoon at 4:30 on BBC Radio 4.